Okay, we do have some time for some questions, and we'll start you off with one. In fact, I see someone in the audience that's going to provide us some insight. Larry Morrell, please stand up and go to the microphone. I got a question for you. Now,
that has never happened to me before, where I've actually been asked to ask a question. I usually don't get.
That's right.
I usually. Well, anyway.
I may even get let you give an answer. I'll ask the question. Even better. We've made Larry a last-minute panelist, unbeknownst to him. Larry served as the commissioner in the District of Columbia at the time the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act was being formed. And there was some really interesting developments. And what I'd like you to maybe share with people is some of the experiences you had when you would you are surrounded by Virginia and Maryland, I believe, and in certain circumstances, the price for terrorism coverage would be dramatically different if you happened to cross the street. Do you recall some of those experiences, Larry?
And I'll try to be short in describing them because they're a lot of fun. I could talk all day about them, and I know that I have friends here from ISO, so I don't want to insult them in any way, but. When they first came out with the models and the ratings after 9/11, they had the country divided into three tiers, and the amount that was to be charged for terrorism risk in each tier varied very widely, and D.C. was in tier one, and I called ISO and said, "Why? I thought you guys went on past experience. There's been no attack on D.C." "Well, what about the Pentagon?" they said. I said, "Well, that's in Virginia, but that you have rated Virginia as tier three. "Well, but everybody knows the government is in Washington." I said, "You don't insure the government. You insure private facilities, and we are unfortunately deficient in those in D.C. "Yeah, but they're near the government. You know, there's a lot of problems. They're near the government. They can be injured by collateral damage." "Well, not really. I mean, by and large, the government facilities are pretty well isolated from the commercial area. They have wide areas around them." And then they had done something that I thought was particularly strange. They had divided vertically between buildings that were more than 10 stories and buildings that were less than 10 stories. I said, "If you made that 14 stories, we'd have a deal, because D.C. has height limitations. It can't build buildings more than 13 stories." And they were categorizing D.C. with Chicago and New York. And then finally, and this was the one that Eric mentioned, all of D.C. was Tier 1, and all of Maryland and Virginia was Tier 3. And I said, "How am I going to tell my Neiman Marcus store that is out on Wisconsin Avenue, just south of Western Avenue, that their risk of terrorism insurance is 100 times greater than the risk for Saks Fifth Avenue, which has a store across the street in Maryland? And it doesn't make sense to them. How am I going to tell them that?" Well, we did a lot of maneuvering, and we got the thing a little better. We never got it really right, and I don't think it can be gotten right, because you really don't learn from experience in this area. The next attack is not likely to come where the last one was.
Thank you very much, Larry, because that gives an interesting perspective on things. Now, do you have a question for our panelists?
Yeah, I mean, I was sitting here and saying that the market works very well as long as there aren't any major attacks. The same thing with hurricanes. You know, as long as there isn't a major hurricane, the market works very well. What happens when there's the next major attack? Then what? What happens to all of the things that you guys just finished saying?
That's a very thought-provoking question. Mike, you want to take a stab at that first?
I guess when you look at what happens when you have significant events in our industry, and there's been a number of them, and again, when you think of significant, a few things happen. One, we've got a backstop, but to the extent that there's, when you look at what's happened after, say, Katrina, Rita, Wilma, right, you saw the formation of new capital formed. Reinsurance vehicles, small reinsurance companies. After 9/11, saw the same thing. After Hurricane Andrew, saw the same thing. To the extent that there is a big loss, you know, the formation of new companies, formation of new capital into the industry may be one of those things that happens. you know, you see rates obviously go up. You see rating agencies, typically regulators, respond in terms of, you know, were we holding enough capital for these types of events? I think of what happened after 2005, after Katrina. You know, the rating agencies really came from one perspective to really went very strongly from one side to the other in terms of changing the capital requirements for insurers and reinsurers. So there is that issue of more capital restraints. And when you do that, obviously, since your companies are trying to target a certain return on capital, pricing has got to change as well. There's always that blame on the models. Why did the models get it wrong? And again, I think there is this issue. And as actuaries, we try to really talk to our colleagues about this, that we don't want to get ourselves to a point where we're over-relying too much on models. You know, we have to understand the insights that a model gives us. We have to understand the driver's sensitivity test and understand really the parameters that go into that. And what I think happens, though, is I think we, as an industry, we take our lessons that have been learned. We, depending upon how big the event is, does that drive new entrants into the market? Does that take entrants out of the market? That we've certainly seen that happen in the past. But I do think because of just the nature of the beast, and I try to really, you know, you start with life insurance and personal auto insurance to one extent, to one end of the spectrum, to hurricane and earthquake insurance as the other end, you know, terrorism is just so far beyond that. And there are certainly areas where we think we understand hurricane insurance, that there's only been, you know, there are 10 to 15 hurricanes that happen a year. Most of them stay out to sea. We haven't seen that many earthquakes in the last, you know, several decades. Although 2010, 2011, internationally, we certainly had our share of them. New Zealand had three in particular. But since terrorism is so far out there, this is really an area where we need, you know, I think the backstop is important to keep the market moving.
Well, thank you, Mike. Other panelists, Robert?
Yeah, if I may comment on that. TRIA, I've always thought, is most critical to protect the resiliency of our economy after an attack, even more importantly than before. When you have a natural catastrophe hit the insurance marketplace, new capital floods in, you know, from Bermuda and elsewhere because investors expect that rates may harden, and there's no correlation between having a hurricane 1 month and you know, some other tornado or similar nat cat the next month. They're completely independent events. But with terrorism, we know that 9/11 involved four coordinated attacks, and the insurance markets feared that more were in the works, and in fact, more were in the works, and Al-Qaeda had other ongoing plots. Without TRIA, after 9/11, we saw the insurance marketplace pulling back because of that fear of additional attacks, and that was one of the primary reasons that we created TRIA. And so without a TRIA in place, you know, the economy might stagger along with some losses without an event, but if an event does occur and there's no TRIA, then there's no mandate that primary insurers offer coverage. There's no box of certainty for insurer losses, and that means that if an event occurs, there may be great hesitancy from the insurers and the reinsurers to put new capital into the marketplace. So I think that's probably the most important reason to have TRIA for our economic resiliency after an event.
Yeah, I think that's very insightful. I think TRIA, I look at it as the Band-Aid that keeps the industry involved in providing a coverage that they otherwise aren't really enthused about providing. Let's talk a little bit about workers' comp compared to other lines of business. Workers' comp is essentially a statutory creation created well before terrorism was considered to be a threat to injuring employees while on the job. And creates some rather unique circumstances for the industry. Any of you want to comment, provide perspectives on treatment of workers' comp versus treatment of other lines of business? They're all jumping up here. Okay.
Sure. I think the first thing around the workers' comp issue is, of course, that it's mandatory, but in places where there are huge accumulations of workers, it becomes difficult. Absent a TRIA backstop, you can envision carriers fearing substantial accumulations and leaving markets, and the result of that would be workforces being dispersed over broader geographic areas in order to avoid those accumulations. And so that would certainly challenge the way in which American businesses operate, and it could threaten beyond that, core business districts and the tax revenues that they generate and all the social services that come along with it. So that's sort of a snapshot of one potential impact in the absence of TRIA as it relates to workers' comp. An alternative to that would be states taking on a greater role in really being the carrier, and then all manner of questions about the capitalization of that carrier, could rise from, more or less political-oriented premiums being set rather than truly actuarial premiums.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. One of our most vigorous industry advocates in the last TRIA go-around was the workers' compensation state funds. Because private insurers, as Eric said, can't exclude terrorism risk, without TRIA, there's anecdotal evidence that some insurers had to avoid certain high-level risks altogether, and we're still seeing that in the marketplace on an individual basis. Those risks in some states then go back to the state funds, which ironically means you're greatly increasing the government taxpayer exposures. You may be shifting it to the state level, but the exposure then of those state workers' comp funds goes far beyond their ability to cover those losses. So they are very strong supporters of the TRIA program to protect their marketplace and their solvency.
If I can also just add, I'd say I think this is an area where you get, I don't know whether you want to say consumer confusion, but the issues of people, as I mentioned, people aren't required to purchase terrorism insurance. The asterisk to that is except in workers' comp. And so, you see people where they're in the middle of Kansas, and the question then becomes, wait a second, why am I having to purchase this terrorism coverage? And that obviously, as I said, comes because of the interactions between the state laws and the federal laws, not necessarily pointing to one or the other. And I think that it may be instructive if you think about, in a broader sense, you want to get terrorism coverage as broad as possible from an insurance perspective. From a future loss perspective, it would be better to have the insurance in place than not. But there are obviously significant... There are people out there who don't think that they need to purchase it. And so I think that in going forward, it's an interesting question to say, if you want to try to get take-up rates up, what kinds of things might you do to try to get those take-up rates up?
Yeah, one thing I'd like to add, when I think of workers' compensation insurance, I mean, you think of something where, there's some public policy there that it's a very highly regulated line of business. Business owners want low rates, obviously, because of just what it does to commerce and the economy. And I feel at times we can be, as an industry, a little schizophrenic on this. Workers' comp is one of the hardest lines to price. When you think of what's happened in medical trends and medical technology and just lifespans, life expectancy has increased. Workers' compensation has probably the largest tail of our standard lines of business. And you're forecasting into the future things like the future cost of medical, the future cost of certain procedures that would happen. So medical inflation is obviously a big driver, and it creates a lot of uncertainty in the pricing absent a catastrophic element in the workers' compensation coverage. And that's why I used the example earlier with a friend of mine who was looking at an account. It was a small account. One of your poster childs for a workers' comp account you'd love to write, right? A bunch of office workers. And when so many, meet a tragic end in one single accident, you know, could have wiped out half of the company's capital or a third of the company's capital. There is this element of catastrophic risk or clash exposure where, whether it's an earthquake or an act of terrorism, that workers' compensation is very susceptible to. And for many, many years, it was not contemplated in the pricing of the product. And when we have something that's very hard to price to begin with because of the future of medical costs and the longevity of the tail of it, and you add to this a catastrophic component, it becomes a very difficult thing to price. And the need for some sort of whether it's trip or whether it's other some form of exposure management for the insurer is very important.
Thank you. Yes, there's a microphone right behind you.
Good morning. My name is Nick Pearson. I'm with Edward Wildman. It's often been said the problem with the military is that they're always fighting the last war. I'm wondering what the panel thinks about TRIP and cyber attacks. It's been the subject of a lot of discussion lately. The next terrorist attack may well be a cyber attack on our physical infrastructure, financial infrastructure, the cost of which, of course, could be enormous. So how will that be responded to under the program as it's presently written, and should that be a major driver for the program going forward and its reauthorization? Thank you.
Baird?
Well, to start, and I know Robert will jump in after, the law itself doesn't mention the word cyber. It is sort of implicitly covered, assuming that the coverage is written as part of a covered line that the private insurers are covering, then a cyber attack is covered. So, and this is something Robert and I were talking about, where exactly the cyber coverage is located in terms of line, because there are some excluded lines. If the coverage is under a covered line, one could say that you don't necessarily need to address it. It is addressed to the same degree that any other terrorist attack would be covered under the program. If it's not written under one of those lines, then if you want to make it more explicit or want to encourage it, then there might need to be changes going forward in the statute.
I'll just add a little bit to Barry's good comments. I sort of put the cyber security into three categories. There's the third-party liability, which is essentially a breach of consumer data, where you have to send out notices to the consumer and you might have some liability for losses. That marketplace has been developing over the last 15, 20 years and is fairly robust at this point. It's generally written, although not always, as part of the professional liability lines, which is an excluded line from TRIA. Then there's the first-party loss of intellectual property, business interruption that is often covered, as Baird suggests, as a part of commercial property or comprehensive general liability policies, although there are some exclusions there. That marketplace, I think there's been some suggestion among our members that perhaps there's more supply than demand. The problem is, while businesses are used to the legal liability of the consumer data breach and are buying that, the sort of cyber risk is something that's really being handled by their IT people, hasn't made its way into the ERM planning process. But as there are some more lawsuits and greater recognition over time, in that area, that the demand will increase. And, in fact, where consumers are starting to buy it, they rarely stop buying it, but it's really just an education process. Then the third category is the cyber catastrophe risk, sometimes called cyber hurricane risk, where you might have power grids coming down or internet systems going down across a broad swath. You have an enormous potential aggregation of risk. That's something that the marketplace is very immature with respect to covering. No one's quite sure how to cover it. We don't really have the data available to know how likely the attacks are. I mean, you read in the papers almost every day now about Chinese infiltrating our critical infrastructure security systems. So that is a huge, enormous risk. The administration believes it's their top national security risk currently. There's a massive government effort underway involving numerous agencies to understand that risk, and they believe that insurance can be a critical part of the solution, both in terms of improving the resiliency of the marketplace after an event to make sure that businesses get back on their feet, but also, like we see in workers' compensation and some of the other commercial policies, to price according to the policyholders' loss mitigation efforts, and even in some cases to guide them to the appropriate loss mitigation efforts. So those talks are very much underway and very much a part of a critical discussion in the administration and starting to seep into Congress.
I'm Joe Gunset from Lloyd's. My question is maybe for you, Tom, and Robert a little bit. Question is, how important is it for the industry to get engaged and for and to work closely with regulators on this issue? Because it's always seemed to me it's less important to the industry because you can always limit your exposure than it is for the economies of our major cities and financial centers. And I'm wondering, what is the challenge in Washington? We talked yesterday a little bit about it. On the one hand, you have a lot of new members of Congress. On the other hand, you have things like I just read in the Insurance Insider with capacity at an all-time high, reinsurance capacity of $505 billion, as reported by Aon Benfield. How difficult is it, first, to explain insurance and what the program, how it really works, and it's not a freebie for the industry? And then how difficult is it beyond that to say this program really has to be renewed in some fashion in the current climate in Washington?
Needless to say, Joe, you have a lot of work ahead of you in this space. And it's just interesting, and I'm looking around the room, and I certainly will be getting more educated, getting people back in and focused on from the state regulator perspective, but there's been a lot of regulator turnover since 2007, and it'll be our job as an AIC to get out to the states and make sure that people understand so that they're interacting with their members of Congress. But seeing how the proponents of the people in the room actually aren't regulators, it's your job to go back and make sure that the regulators that you're interacting with are getting this back on their radar screens, reaching out to the NAIC, and getting this into the conversation, and sooner than later. I mean, yes, we have 18 months, but we definitely, I mean, one of the great things in 2007 was pushing this up to 2014, and all of us who worked on it figured we'd never have to deal with it again. But the downside is that the deficit of information on the Hill, in the administration, and even the state regulatory departments, because people have moved on to doing other things, and because it's worked so well. It's unfortunately the Maytag repairman in a lot of ways. It's a great structure that we don't pay attention enough to. So it's a very good point, Joe, and I think that the industry, and the other thing is, it's not just the insurance industry that's going to make this happen in Congress or make this happen in Washington. It's the people, it's our clients, it's the clients of the insurers, it's the customers, who have in the past, I mean, at the time, actually, the World Trade Center Investment Group was a big, big mover, because the inability to offer insurance just really doesn't get people running down the hallways of Congress. The inability to build that cool new big project in our district because of the lack of this coverage after a certain date is, I think, where the crux of this is going to fall. As Mike said, and as we said, I mean, yes, this could theoretically be retro reauthorized afterwards. The market disruption involved in that is just absolutely horrible to think about. It's thinking about going back to what we were dealing with in 2001, 2002, where projects were just stopped. Been talking to some of the rating agencies and reminding them that their commercial, I hate using acronyms, CMBS, you know, as their ratings CMBS, are they thinking about whether or not there's coverage underneath this for these properties that are backed by these bonds, that are associated with these bonds, and the rating agencies started focusing. But getting these ideas to people's heads sooner rather than later. Obviously, Congress isn't going to do anything until next year, but I think the industry has a twofold role in getting to the customers, getting to regulators, and regulators will have the opportunity then to go make sure that Congress is paying attention. Because really, I mean, of all the things, I mean, flood has a lot of policy about it. Flood insurance program is getting beat up for a lot of its responses along the East Coast. This is everyone's favorite program in Congress. And it's gotten so little noise that you're right, Joe, it's time to get people paying attention again.
Robert, you want to add anything to that? Or?
Tom put it very well.
He certainly did a complete job there. Thanks, Tom. Other questions from the audience? Ralph, did I see you up there near the mic? Yeah, that's a great point, Ralph. I mean, the cyber risk, I think, is one that's evolving constantly, changes every day. And we have to rely on past data because that's what we have. We don't have tomorrow's data yet. Yet it would be really nice if we did. Good example of the auto, you know, you're seeing the advent of the self-driving car, which they expect to be on the streets here, not in the too distant future. You intermix the cyber terrorism with a self-driving car, and we have a bunch of self-driving cars out there, you could see a real mess. We got no data on that yet. Other burning questions out there? George, would you go to the microphone so we can get you on tape here?
George Bradner, Connecticut Insurance Department. I was just wondering, you know, is the working group going to be activated again? It's, you know, it does. I was just looking at the committee requirements for 2013, and I didn't see anything there for the working group. So I was wondering if it's going to be activated again. And one of the things I think for getting it activated and more working on stuff is we're already starting to see conditional terrorism endorsements in the states. And I think, you know, the comment that was made earlier that 28 states had done something with the previous conditional terrorism forms, that there needs to be some conversation among states for consistency purposes.
Yes, the Terrorism Risk Implementation Working Group was reappointed yesterday at the Property and Casualty Committee, and they will be getting engaged here in the very near future, probably with some conference calls to start, and we see them being very active this year and if we're successful this year, that would be great. Maybe they'll have less work to do next year, but probably next year they'll be even more engaged than they are this year. That group has, I believe, 7 or 8 members. Tom mentioned it earlier. The district is on there. New York.
I hate to do this to you, Georgia, but Connecticut's on there. Okay.
So it was you in another life, right? Yeah. Thank you for volunteering, George. Commissioner.
This is more of a technical question for one of the panel members. The language of the Act talks about damage within the United States or mission abroad. Has there been any discussion as to what that means and any implication with respect to U.S. companies doing business abroad?
I always understood mission to specifically be a mission in the United States, not a private entity.
Well, no, I understand that.
Right,
no, I understand
right,
that.
Plus the airplanes. Plus the airplanes, plus cargo. But
yeah. Right. I guess my question is, first of all, is mission a narrow definition? Are we talking about an embassy or a consulate, or is it broader than that? And to the extent that a U.S. company abroad would have damage as a result of an act of terrorism on a mission abroad.
Again, I mean, I guess this almost predates me. I think mission's a noun. Mission's a noun. Well, actually, mission's a structure. Mission's not a, we gave you an assignment, you're off doing this, and then therefore TRIA follows you into the field. But it's a valid question that hasn't really been debated.
Yeah, I mean the language of the statute is the premises of a United States mission. Tom's a lawyer, I'm not, but my assessment of that would be that you're talking about an embassy or something of the sort.
Yeah, the only traveling coverage I think comes on the U.S. Vessels with the United States flag.
So a U.S. company that is adjoining an embassy could possibly look to insurance, even though their facility is abroad.
Probably covering contractors associated with.
That would be a great question. I think one that may be unanswered. Baird, you got anything more you want to say on that? Eric?
I was going to add only that it tends, this is speculative, and I could look into it further. The Department of Defense and State Department have insurance-related programs, you may know, under the Defense Base Act for contractors that serve missions in circumstances such as this, and I presume that to the extent TRIA would extend to missions as a noun rather than an action would entail that kind of service and that kind of contractor. But I'd be happy to look into it further.
I was also thinking of a downtown area of some foreign country, a city in a foreign country, where a private U.S. company would be so close to a U.S. facility that it could actually suffer some damage as well.
My sense is that the coverage would not fall under TRIA in that circumstance, that it would be local or possibly, back to whatever carrier had that portion of it.
Okay, I think we got time for one more question and then perhaps some closing comments from our panel. Anyone want to kick out that last question? One more burning issue? Scott? Great question, Scott. Are we getting Congressman Hensarling dug in? Comments from the panel, please.
I've had conversations with the chairman, and I don't think he's at all hostile to the idea that industry make its case. Certainly there are actions that any particular advocacy, a lobbyist, a trade, what have you, could take that would tick him off. But right now, the chairman's very receptive to the debate about it. I don't think he's going to act. He's going to listen, as Robert said. And I don't anticipate that all the lobbying in the world today is going to create an outcome that is considered well in advance of the program's expiration. But it's important for the advocacy efforts to begin today, if only because it requires those that are advocates of the program to get organized, to spread the word to our clients, to other interested parts of the economy, that this is something that's at risk and potentially goes away absent people organizing and speaking up. So we don't presume to have kind of the mantle on this, but we're working with CEAT, this Coalition to Insure Against Terrorism, which is a bit of an umbrella group and has been involved since the outset, really, in the TRIA program. We're working with them to begin the education process on Capitol Hill and to reach out to more participants in the industry.
Thank you. And any panelists that have closing remarks for us? Tom?
Well, I was just going to follow up on Scott's point, and I think it is good. I mean, Sharon Henseling is a good, strong thinker, open to ideas, open to healthy arguments. He's also been at this for a decade. He's heard a lot of them. There are 434 others that are most of them behind the curve on this information, and it's not about convincing. It's about getting it on people's radar so that when the conversation starts happening, not that there's going to be a wellspring that's going to overtake one chairman of a committee, one very thoughtful, strong chairman of a committee, but the idea that the other people in the room when the conversation starts aren't saying, "Huh, what's this?" Because "Huh, what's this?" then allows that time period where things can start happening quickly from a stronger motivated minority. And I think it really does make sense. You've got a lot of members of Congress who are in the Financial Services Committee, the Banking Committee, and the Senate that have not dealt with this before. And then you've got a lot of members of Congress that it's not in their committee's jurisdictions, but it's awfully darn important to their constituents. And that point needs to be made.
Mike?
Okay. Just some closing. You asked for closing comments. I guess the thing I'd start with is because of the difficulty to measure and to price. You know, it's been nice to see that we've had coverage. The market is available, and it's available because of TRIP. And because of its availability, we've seen the market be very stable and affordable. We've also seen, because of the structure of the program, it's allowed for other forms of insurance or reinsurance to come in and help the primary insurers. When you have that backstop, it allows for, I'll use the word innovation. Innovation is probably a better word, from the reinsurance and the other insurance community. Without it, I think we would definitely see insurers not offer coverage for terrorism. And I think the final point here is, and when you think about the strategy, is that, you know, the cost to the taxpayers, you know, for the administrative cost is negligible. I think we have a handful of people that are also doing other things. And to the extent that there is a large event and that there is a cost, you know, the ability to recoup those costs through the assessments to the insurance industry certainly really helps mitigate the ultimate cost to the taxpayers.
Thank you. Robert?
Well, I think that TRIA has worked very well, but as I think everyone on this panel suggested, faced a significant reauthorization challenge. Critical to our efforts is for the consumers to be very active and to be the face of the advocacy efforts. As Eric said, CEAT will certainly be a critical part of that process. RIMS, who's represented in the room, will be a critical part of the process. A number of the hospitals and universities and amusement parks, football stadiums, sports stadiums, colleges, those will all be a critical part of the process, and we'll really have to get them very active and engaged as we're moving forward. There's a vast education effort that's currently underway. Our polling has suggested that trying to explain all the numbers of TRIA, which the insurance industry tends to want to do, actually makes people hostile rather than supportive of the program. I think you get lost quickly in the numbers, and that makes you a little suspicious. The industry has to get over using some of its old phrases, things like public-private partnership worked great before the financial crisis, but now those same buzzwords that work so well for our old talking points, we've been told, are red flags that don't work at this point. So the messaging is very important. And then we need to work very hard to understand the specific concerns of the members, like Chairman Henserling and Nagebauer and Crapo and Johnson and so forth, and be able to provide extensive factual analysis to address those concerns and to help them think through some of the new issues like the cybersecurity risk. So I think eventually we're going to get there, and going to Scott Gilliam's comments on timing, you know, I agree with Eric and Tom that the education process needs to move forward quickly. At some point, there's going to have to be political pressure, and that's the part that really you have to be very sophisticated in terms of when that comes into the fray to eventually get past the congressional inertia and move it forward. And we'll have to focus on both the intellectual side and the political side in the right combination moving forward.
Okay, Eric or Baird, either one of you have final comments?
I guess I feel compelled to put on a skeptical hat. I would say that when you look at the program from sort of a pure insurance theory type of perspective, and from the way the private market works, it seems rather glaring that it doesn't work like most things in the market. If you go to a private reinsurer and say, yeah, I want coverage now, and if something bad happens, I'll pay you it back after the fact. Nobody works like that. And I think that that gives, from a skeptical point of view, you look at how can a private market develop if you're giving away free reinsurance from the government. That's something that, that people have commented on and picked up on. And I think that there's a certain moral hazard aspect, a lack of advanced behavioral changes that you like to see with an insurance premium that you don't have in this. And so I think that, yeah, there are skeptics, and I know that people have been generally complimentary of it here, but I just want to remind people that when you go out and talk to everyone, there will be people that will have serious concerns, and that is something that people will probably need to address going forward.
All right, thank you. Eric?
Well, yeah, I would say that there are certainly more market-oriented alternatives to TRIA, but they require substantial changes in the way in which society organizes itself. Not to get too kind of big picture here, but the idea of a core business district, again, is threatened by the absence of affordable coverage, not only for the buildings, but for the people. And further, you know, the sporting events that Robert referred to, which are, you know, I mean, they're huge economic drivers, but they're giant societal events. Those are, if not, you know, much more complex, impossible, you know, on an absent some level of government backstop. And so I'm optimistic that TRIA is ultimately reauthorized, but very realistic of the educational effort that lies before us. It will be substantial, and it will require time and many allies. And I also am open to engaging with those policymakers that are skeptical of the current program or perhaps think that the current program doesn't require enough of the private sector because ultimately, you know, it will be a compromised product as we see everything coming out of Congress. So we look forward to releasing our study, and please contact me if you would like a copy of it.
Yeah, we look forward to that, too. Please join me in thanking this wonderful panel. I don't think we could find a more dynamic set of individuals that know the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, know the marketplace the way these fellows do. I think they did an incredible job on this, and I express my appreciation to them as well. Thank you all for attending. Safe travels as you go back to your daily lives, and we hope you enjoyed the CIPR presentation.
Thank you.